You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
And together we're agitating for change in Northern BC. We're calling this episode the final in our series, The Apple of Your Eye. In the first half, our guest in the kitchen is Colin Dring, a professor and researcher at the School of Environment and Sustainability at Royal Roads University. Colin's analytical approach suggests ways for understanding what we heard and saw this summer. He'll help us imagine and celebrate the alternative food systems we discovered in the North that are serendipitously decolonizing our local food systems and practices so we can live closer to the sustainability and equity that we're so hungry for. To end this series, Brenda and I will reflect on what we learned. Time to check the pot one last time and see what's cooking. One year, I spent the fall living in a city right on the equator. Perpetual summer. Being recognized as a Canadian expat, I was teased as a culture that's obsessed with the weather. My argument went that when your country sees the whole range of weather changes, you need to be prepared. On the equator, the shops carry only summer clothing. You're limited to summer sports. There's no such thing as fall foliage. And in the case of Jakarta, Indonesia, access to fresh water is limited, so you're reduced to drinking bottled water. As winter approached, I became homesick, craving a change in the weather. When I landed back in Canada in early December, there was a fresh snowfall. I was home. Precipitation in all its forms is life-giving. Canadians complain that we get what we consider too much or not enough, but we're also pragmatic enough to realize it's not under our control and to make the best of what we have. We have a reputation for being outdoorsy, for loving sports, for being industrious and creative in our approach to life, because we grew up on change, and for setting aside our differences when things get complicated, and including others, because that's how you survive, together because of the weather conditions. When I think of Canada, I think of having a snowball fight with my neighbor, of friends floating down a river in and on various watercraft, of drinking fresh, cool water from a glacier-fed stream. Precipitation is life-giving and community-building.
Yeah, I do a fair amount of work across the fields of education, food systems transformation. I'm trained as a planner. I do agriculture, food systems planning, climate change, program evaluation. I ran a food security nonprofit in my hometown of Richmond for a number of years. We led several community-based and health-based research projects, as well as policy reform. I am a huge geek about food systems governance, and everything that I do is really tempered through a social justice and decolonial lens. I mean, the issues that folks are facing in rural BC are very similar to elsewhere. There's some specific nuances, but the challenges are sneakily the same. There's a lot that we can unpack. I think I shared with you folks a couple planning tools that we had developed with the Public Health Association of BC. Those had been tested out and developed across three communities, Prince George, Prince Rupert, and Revelstoke. My current research project that I'm leading is based out of Prince Rupert, where we're building some anti-colonial teaching approaches, which are trying to support local food and community actors to center social justice decolonial practices as part and parcel of their planning and governance work. The reason we started doing that is because we've met, actually, let me share just some other cred. I used to be part of the BC Food Systems Network, which was a provincial network going back, I think, to like 1996. It was disbanded or rendered dormant like several years ago. But it was very much a grassroots network of people who were working on localizing food systems, building relationships with Indigenous peoples, building resilient food systems, very much across the province, which meant that we worked exclusively almost with a lot of rural communities and the challenges rural communities were facing. So yeah, across the networks that we've been working on, when I got connected with the BC Food Systems Network over 10 years ago, 15 years ago, questions around social justice, around anti-oppression, food sovereignty wouldn't have been the terminology being used at the time, but these ideas were starting to percolate and coming up, and people were really contending with these ideas of white supremacy culture, with privilege, and the role of people in these very diverse spaces trying to contend with these harms that were coming out of food systems and the implications for people in those communities, particularly people who are experiencing marginalization or exploitation at the time. So this was very much becoming front and center, this idea of food justice, of decolonizing food systems. But people have a lot of interest in it, but not a lot of tools and supports and mechanisms to integrate or to apply. And so we've been really called to trying to support people to build that capacity, with mixed results, right? And the mixed results are that you can't expect anybody who's like seeped within these cultures, within these norms, to just magically go to a workshop and then be like, well, I'm decolonized. It's a much deeper, more challenging, long-term set of practices that at any given moment, and I think this is like a core thing of privilege, is that you can just stop. You can effectively just say, you know what, this is too much work. It's too stressful. It's too emotional. It's too hard. I'm stressed out. I'm losing time, all this kind of stuff. Unfortunately, the people who are impacted by it don't have that as a choice. And so really, as a researcher, as an activist, as someone who'd been working in this for years, as someone who is impacted by those systems, really been trying to support particularly people with privilege to build their capacity to integrate social justice and decolonial practices.
Can I ask you, if you're working with Prince Rupert, are we talking mostly about the fishing industry? Is that the food security that you're talking about there?
Prince Rupert has kind of thrown a wrench in the thinking around food that we've been. So traditionally, I would say, and for the most part, most of food planning focuses on agricultural practices, on like land-based, I would say. So to a lesser extent, we're starting to talk about soilless, vertical, controlled environment kind of systems, hydroponics, aquaponics, those kind of things. And it really neglects the foreshore and water-based systems. So Prince Rupert has thrown a wrench into my plans because, from a jurisdictional level, the fisheries and agriculture are very siloed. And those are distinct and I think intentionally distinct systems. So to answer your question, yes, we have had to start working in fisheries because fisheries is such a central component. One of our project partners, EcoTrust Canada, as well as the local Ko-Sim-Sien nations, we've necessarily had to engage in both fisheries and foreshore and questions of water and water management and fisheries management, alongside all of the other agrarian, like agri-corporate, agri-food, built environment, all of that at the same time. So it's a real mess out there.
Well, that explains why you've chosen, I think you said Revelstoke and Prince George, and then Prince Rupert to me was the odd man out, so that was why I asked.
Yeah. Prince Rupert. So the reason we picked these three communities at the time of this previous project was our partnership with the Public Health Association of BC. They had strong connections with local civil society and local government across those three case communities. So we wanted to leverage that we knew we had a group of people who were kind of on the ground, maybe coordinating, but definitely like engaging in projects and programs, trying to advance some kind of change within their local food systems, their local areas. And we knew that there were a group of people in there that had those relationships to begin with.
Okay.
Because it's very, very challenging for us to come in as researchers. You may have heard the expression like the parachute researcher. As someone who does a lot of community engaged scholarship, community-based research, like it's antithetical to think about coming into a community for 6 months and then disappearing to never be heard of again. And we really didn't want that to be the case with any of the folks that we were working with. We really wanted to ensure that we were creating these kind of long-term relationships with them, knowing again that, like, as I said, you can't just attend a TED talk by the brilliant Dr. Colin Dring and be miraculously transformed into something else. It just doesn't happen that way, unfortunately.
what drove you into this work, inspired you to go into this work? What's the food system you also want to eat from? So is there a certain goal that led you into this work?
When I was in the city of Richmond, so I was there working, it was my hometown as well. And you kind of grow up, I'm a mixed race as well. So my mom was born in Beijing. My dad is three generations Canadian, then goes back to England. And so we grew up in a very multicultural part of the world, but a very multicultural, and categories of difference are not simple. So for example, you have nine generations of diasporic Chinese descent people who have lived there longer than many Canadians can claim their heritage lines, right? They're Canadians through and through. And then you have people like my mom who immigrated this generation. And so you have vastly different experiences of what it means to be ethnically Chinese, but to also have very different relationships to food based on these generational differences, even though our colonial structure wants to collapse all of that difference and just be like, you're both ethnically Chinese. We also saw a fair amount of difference in income level. Like the wealth gap in Richmond is like very pronounced. And so growing up, I was very privileged to be from a middle class, to have a more tolerant society, we would say. And when I came back to Richmond to do this work around food, I was shocked at how the demographics of food work in my home community, given that 46% of people at the time were of white racial background. The lack of representation of any diversity within food work was alarming. And I started working with a group at the time. They were called Shark Truth. They were a group of Chinese descent people working on the issue of shark conservation and specifically working to end the practice of shark fin soup. And this is like an excellent story unto itself. And I would encourage you to follow up with these folks if you're ever interested. But one of the things that this experience taught me is we talked about achieving this goal of sustainability, but also what it meant to have a cultural identity. You can interplay a Chinese cultural identity with a Asian identity, with a person experiencing disability identity. These are all kind of cultural or social archetypes, each of them having their own set of relationships to sustainability. And, you know, for us, we understood that some of our things that we valued as culture were not sustainable. And the imperative to act on those practices that were not sustainable had to be driven by those of us who were part of the culture. And so this was kind of the clarion cry of our group, was we desired sustainability for multiple generations. We were strong proponents of that. Shark fin happened to be the hot topic issue of the day. And like the people that I was working with, Kevin Huang and Claudia Lee, they were actively working with chefs in China, celebrities, to transform the national dialogue around this food practice. As this was happening simultaneously, two, we'll say like Western white-led conservation groups came and started to insert themselves into the shark fin soup conversation. It might shock you to know that they did not approach it in a respectful or humble way. They did not look to find out who was already working on this issue within culture, and instead went direct to ethnic and racial shaming and guilt and slurs as a way to advance their value, their agenda. And so what this did is this created a conflict between, and it was a false conflict, like a racialized conflict that didn't exist before, that all you really had to do was like do a little bit of digging, be a little bit more respectful. And instead what it did was it entrenched a cultural practice that then would not shift. Very famously, one of the local MLAs is on media, like eating a bowl of shark fin soup as part of this controversy to push back, right? But imagine like what that did to the work that we were doing and how challenging it was to advance that position. So this kind of experience continues. Like this isn't just a localized, it's pretty much anywhere you go, you start to see that the social categories, they matter. And who is responsible and who is working on it matters. And who is invisible and who is excluded, it matters. our processes for engagement, which was we would hold an open house and invite everyone in. And sure enough, none of the target people that we wanted to come would come because we didn't have those relationships, but also because we disrespected them so much that we wouldn't go to their places. And so I had to really change the way that I worked. So I went to churches, synagogues, temples. I went to immigrant societies. I went to anywhere that would accept me as a speaker to come and meet with staff and volunteers. I came to them in my role to talk about food and to see how we could work together and if there was a readiness to work together. So that was a really pivotal moment for me because it continues to shape the approach to the work. Is I rarely will advocate for people to use shame or guilt as a mechanism to advance equality and fairness. I don't think it works very well. But instead, I think we talk a lot more about responsibility and accountability and those kinds of things. Yeah, it was such a bummer because it became so vitriolic, and nothing is more frustrating than having the rug pulled out from under you and wondering like where these people have come from and why they're chiming in at this point in time.
I don't think anybody could argue that what has been happening with that situation needs to change.
It's such a bummer to realize that, you know, all of this hard work gets thrown out when it becomes an oppositional terrain. When the conversation is less about how do we support people to shift their cultural practices and more to how do we vilify people for their cultural practices. And like this also goes to questions around whiteness or questions around people who are extremely wealthy, right? These are still cultural modes of being. And our aim is still to support people as they transition out, not to further entrench them in.
It's making me think, and this is a new parallel for me, especially being now living in a space where the First Nations culture is the dominant, of how white people are trying to impose what's actually considered native food or not. The work that the Indigenous Food Sovereignty Association is doing around even their recent paper that was put out around like, there was agriculture here. It just didn't look like European agriculture. So no one saw it to acknowledge it. Or the question of how long does a plant have to be growing here to be considered native? Allowing, yeah, in a way, the sovereignty and the choice and people supporting a culture to transform itself and not telling it how it's allowed to transform or how it must transform.
Yeah, I think there's also this tendency, I mean, also within certain branches of Indigenous food sovereignty, to homogenize it, to make it pan-Indigenous. My friend and dear colleague, Tabitha Robin, she's a professor at UBC. We talk about what it means to pluralize Indigenous food sovereignty and food sovereignty, right? Self-determination is not singular, it's multiple. And if we want to honor and respect self-determination of Indigenous peoples, of diasporic communities, of even settler colonial people, to a certain extent, you know, where tolerance and acceptance is like the mainstay, not dominance and exploitation. But if that's the case, then we have to see it as a plurality of how we work across this diversity, this heterogeneity of food relations that are mediated through a diversity of cultures, not a singular one.
It reminds me like the work that Christine did at the Hampers in Smithers around just challenging the idea that maybe not everybody wants a turkey at Christmas.
Or even challenging the idea that not everyone can and should cook things from scratch. I'm being a little glib right now, so take it with a grain of salt, nutritionists, dietitians. But the mainstay is that you prepare your food from scratch, you grow it yourself, you harvest it, you make it all in your kitchen, you process all of your stuff, and that's the constituent now of a healthy diet. And there's a lot of concerns with that because A, it's ableist at its background. It requires a huge privilege of time and energy. Presumes that like the mode of eating, like the practice of eating, is individual or heteronormatively family. And so these ideas of communal or collective eating and preparation become less than their special occasions, whereas they could be daily, they could be our regular relationship to food is to feed each other, not to feed ourselves.
I'm going back to my days in Singapore where like I wanted an oven and like they were literally sending me pictures, like, and even just sat on the, because there was nowhere to put it in, right? Because people, yeah, it's so much more communal. Most of the eating in the evening time was done out through restaurants, but it was the community out on sidewalks around round tables sharing, right? It was like, I was so novel to them that this was the one piece of thing that I wanted, because the culture I grew up in was that ideal that you just named.
Inuit communities, a kitchen for an Inuit community should not look like a sink at 3 foot high with, you know, cupboards and all that. Like maybe like part of what is a kitchen, you know, you might have a sloping concrete floor with a drain system, right? And that would be your kitchen. When I work with people with disabilities and they're living in these spaces where half of their food storage, whether cold or dry, is outside of their reach. So the way that we internalize these norms and they become then reaffirmed through our food practices.
So as you're going out, what kind of a response are you receiving even from different players in the food system? Are there certain people who show up that surprise you? Are there people who aren't showing up?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, nothing really surprises me in terms of who shows up, who doesn't show up. I think it's because the messiness of day-to-day life means that whoever can show up should show up. Or to put it differently, the right people are the people who are there. And so we always kind of work in that vein. The other piece too, because I think I'm very wary of the binary of inclusion and exclusion. And so we create inclusive spaces as much as we can. We recognize that some people and groups just don't have those relationships. I'll share a little anecdote about, like, again, Richmond is like highly diverse. And so multiple different languages, multiple different cultures, ethnicities, all sorts of diversity there. And it was very easy to like go around the room and be like, okay, I'm looking at the room. I'm looking at the demographic composition of the room. I'm looking at the food systems players. And I'm saying like, who is here? Who's not here? And it's kind of a soul sucking task because of the complexity of food work. The idea that you can host a meeting and everybody can show up is pretty wild. So you have to have multiple ways of engaging people. But one of the things that I really appreciated was getting scolded by a group. So part of what this was signaling to me, so an example was a Filipino organization had reached out and they were like, we were unable to come to your last event. Like, you haven't reached out to us. Like, we would like to be part of this, but like, you're not showing up, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you know what? This is great. Because this signals to me that you have time to create a relationship. This issue of food has become important enough for your members, for your community, that you have the energy to come and like call me out. And I love it because it means that you have the energy then to create a relationship. And I didn't have the time or energy to create hundreds of relationships or to hunt people down when they're not ready. So this question of readiness is a real core concept. Yes, we can support people to get to ready. We can support them to kind of understand how colonialism impacts food system, how these different inequalities are foundational to our food system issues, that much of this is by design. It's not an accident. That can expedite the getting to ready and readiness pieces. But I think we also can't presume that people can and do have the ability, the safety even, to be able to step into that. Right? I think that there's a hard line there around being able to participate fully or being able to participate within a way that works for you. And particularly because I think in like North American culture, we have such an idea of like, you're either going full hog or nothing. Think about some of the most diehard dietary people that you might know. And, you know, that's not what we want either. We want people to be able to be met where they're at, to be supported, and to also have the capacity to support other people through that process. It's around collective accountability and collective support. So to come back to your question, yeah, we're not surprised that like the corporate bigwigs aren't showing up to the conversation. We're not surprised that the federal provincial governments aren't like breaking down my door to run training sessions for their employees and to build novel policy and regulation. Like, none of that is surprising to me. Some of the other elements around like people that are notably absent, like they've been identified. And so it's coming back to that question of, is there readiness in that group to be included? So for example, like I have a strong desire to include a youth voice, and this has been echoed by my collaborators in Rupert and Lehane. And so we really want to make sure that, you know, an Indigenous and non-Indigenous youth voice is centered in ongoing food systems governance and planning. And so is there a group that's ready to go? I mean, I hope they're listening to this podcast and they're excited to come join that. But the reality is, like, we have to just be open and receptive and keep putting the call out. And then when that group manifests, like, we're ready to build that relationship with them and to support them to do it.
I like in your story also that people have the desire and the passion to be included, so much so that they call you out. I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, I wish that they would call me in as well, but like I can handle the scolding. I grew up in a culture that like scolding was a very useful motivational tool for young people. Fundamentally, it's a mistake. It's a mistake on our part that's like low cost, but it's a mistake that allows us to learn and then to create something out of it, to see it as generative, not so much of a failure on our part, but of a readiness and humility to be able to hear that and say, well, I'm excited that you want to be a part of this. Some people will call you out and you'll never hear back from them. And that tells you something about like where they or their community or their group is at. And again, that's okay. There's no judgment there. And if they are, of course, like a critical group that you need to get on board, well, there's different strategies that you can use to move there. But I think for the kind of work that we do, we're really trying to center more of that care and reciprocity and humility and sacredness and even joy, right? Even though like most of the work that I do is pretty awful, like I face a lot of human wrongs in the work that I do, it's still necessary to be able to find joy and levity and humor like in those processes, in those spaces.
I think in my experience, I've had to bring a lot of humility to situations around food security, because I would never want to presume to come into a situation where I'm telling them how they should be eating. But I also need to continually remind myself that maybe my eating practices are not what I want for my life. And there has to be a lot of openness to sit together around a table and put everything on the table and be able to discuss it openly and gently. And you're right, with joy. I don't think we can do anything without the joy and the humility.
Yeah. And I would add to that, like we function from a place of kind of exuberant consent. It's not that you shouldn't tell people what to eat. It's that you shouldn't tell people what to eat if they have not asked you and given consent to right. be told what to eat. So there's something really powerful about like the deep feminists have this beautiful expression, and I use it often. It's called an authority that authorizes. So it's recognizing that you do have power. And part of that power is to release power, which is a really interesting idea, right? Like normally under a hyper-masculinized society, we're like, no, accumulate power, because the ideas of dominance are so ingrained in that echelon of the manosphere. But really what we're looking for is consensual engagement, which is to say, yeah, you can be told how to eat, but there should be a consent process in there. You should be able to sit down and air and discuss openly in joyful consent. So it's a subtle distinction, but I think it's an important one as part of that invitation in, and to model how we care for one another is we care by seeking that kind of permission from the people we work with, but also to be permitted to be held and cared for in turn.
I used to work for a fast-moving consumer goods company that was based in Europe, and the European Union wanted to bring across the traffic light labeling. Mm-hmm. And that whole idea, like, we're saving people time, they don't have to think about it, let's just put a red, a green, and a yellow on items. But because it was fast-moving consumer goods, there was lots of chocolate and candy involved. But if you do it that simplistically, so it also look like, how's this going to get applied? If you just literally look at sugar, a lot of fruit's going to end up with red because they had simplified it so far to just make sugar red because there's lots of sugar in fruit, not thinking fiber, what's the source of sugar, what's the kind. And even consumers, the purchasers, the citizens said, don't treat me like I'm that stupid. Help me. I don't want to have to read a book on every item. Still, yes, the red, yellow, green's helpful, but also put some of the information around how many grams and what kind. And so it kind of came to this middle ground. They still implemented traffic light labeling, but it was about how do we plain language some of that data to help people quickly make decisions in the grocery store, but still trust that they can make those decisions.
And what's really kind of fascinating about that is, like, it goes back to this idea of, like, what kind of relationship to food does that reaffirm? How does that reproduce? So again, like, highly individualistic, maybe like for you, your friends, your family, that like assumes that you're going to grocery stores as like your primary mechanism. Like, so the economy of food like is capitalist. So it further entrenches those lock-ins. And then you can't ask the question of like, well, what is the end goal here? The goal is to get people healthy and like eating is part of being healthy, but why is this the mechanism? Right. And then to double down on singular fixes or not like a complete like wraparound package. It's something that like we've seen in Canada. I don't know if you both are familiar, but Canada is a signatory to the United Declaration of Universal Human Rights. And one of those human rights is to food. But what that means implemented in this country has largely been some funding to the charity sector. And then, as we've seen more recently, a national food program, like very recently, which is shocking when you think about our neighbors to the south, who we would think are actually doing much worse than we are in terms of food. But constitutionally, they have a right, I might butcher this, but it's the right to be free from hunger. It's kind of a weird, almost negative right is what it's affirmed to. But what it's meant is that they have a federal responsibility to their citizens around food, which then like make for very different relationships to food and how those relationships are mediated. There's a group of people who are talking about Canadian constitution and food being a part of it. I mean, it's part of an issue that we continuously face in this country of housing, food, clean water, clean environment. Those should be constitutionally protected things, but they are in fact not. Folks that are trying to localize or create more regional food systems, part of the challenge in creating these alternatives, and you understand where it's coming from, is because of these top-down these structures that you really don't have a lot of choice. This idea of like you sacrifice convenience and efficiency for sustainability, for self-determination, for having your traditional food ways, of having intact ecosystems, right? All of that is part and parcel of our modern relationship to food. I remember one of the things that blew my mind was, you know, you go into a contemporary supermarket and there is a real abundance of choice. There is an old film about an American soldier who was in the Vietnam War. He brought back to America this Vietnamese woman as his bride. And like, I think it was like her first time walking into an American supermarket, and she just has a full breakdown because it's wild to think about this abundance of choice and food all in this industrial sized warehouse. But the thing that's kind of shocking about all of that is that none of those choices are market derived in the sense of like, it's not a free market. Everything that's placed in that store is placed there under competition and in bidding and sponsorship. Like all of those products, they aren't there because they're the best product and they're trying to get the best product into you. No, it's competing for shelf space. Like it really breaks that illusion of freedom of choice. Like the choice, even though the choice is massive and there's a lot of it, has still been constructed. And I think that's something that we really struggle with, is that scale of manipulation. And that's why these local food systems are very, very appealing as an alternative. However, if you are seeped in those logics and those norms of a relationship to food that's commodified, you tend to reproduce those things at the localized level. And so there really has to be a significant amount of vigilance where you're not recreating those same structures, those same inequities. So like farmers market is like the de facto example of like, for a farmer to be viable, they have to sell their product at a higher price point. That higher price point can only be purchased by wealthier people, which means that the folks who desperately would benefit most from having access to those products cannot. And it's a real bummer because then we see these other systems come into place, like community farms, as a way to donate food to food banks, or what was it? There's the ugly food donations that some folks out in the Fraser Valley were doing. You know, and like you have to get real creative to be able to get really high quality, nutrient dense food, culturally appropriate food into the people who need it most, because they can't use money as their strategy.
You are listening to Tempest in a Stockpot. I'm Christine Bruce.
And I'm Brenda Barrett.
Before the break, Colin Dring, a professor and researcher at Royal Roads University, offered insights into how the North is decolonizing our local food systems for a more just society. It made us proud to live here. Now, we'll return to that conversation for a bit, and then Brenda and I will close out with a few reflections of our own, revealing how these conversations changed our own assumptions and biases, making us both more determined to champion local and fresh on behalf of those who grow, produce, and distribute nutritious food in Northern BC.
Both Christine and I, as part of our role, is through the BC Farmers Market Coupon Program. I'm curious if you have comments and what your comments might be in responses to that, that as a trying to create maybe some equity.
I'm a parallel strategies kind of guy. So I think like have the coupon program, recognize under which conditions the coupon program is meeting the outcome that you want it to meet, recognize its shortcomings and its failures, and recognize that it was not a tool designed to end this food inequality. So to only rely on the technical administrative fix that is the coupon program while allowing all these other things to continue, that's a problem. And so I think like, again, part of the challenge is like not pointing at the coupon program and saying all in, this is going to fix our food security problems, but saying rather the coupon program meets this chunk of the pie. What is the 50 other things that we have to do to meet the remainder of the pie?
And they're lobbying to get things bought, not necessarily to feed people.
Like the challenge with the coupon program is like there are definitely barriers in terms of like what you can use it for, what you can't use it for. Also just general physical accessibility barriers around getting to and from a farmer's market. The idea that you have the time and energy to go to multiple different market venues is also, I think, a function of privilege. When I was working with people experiencing poverty, actually like multiple municipalities. So it's a consistent thing is like being poor is a full-time job. The like neoliberal folks who believe that you can magic your way out of poverty don't really understand that the way that the system is designed is even from a spatial level, you have to move across a city to meet all of your services in a day. So your food bank is not magically co-located next to your social services center. That's not how it works. So you may have to take a bus or walk vast distances to be able to do that. So adding a farmer's market in, which is typically in less central locations, depending on like the size of your municipality, that can be an extra challenge.
And at times that maybe not be convenient for everybody. And our local farmers, they grow what they know they'll sell, which is restrictive if you come from a culture that doesn't eat what he's growing or she is growing. So it is very limiting. You can only have the coupons if you're pregnant or have small children or you're a senior. There's a huge gap in the middle of the working poor.
Yeah.
There are so many restrictions. And it's not only the Farmers Market Coupons Program, but that's based on our Canada's Food Guide, which is incredibly colonial and restrictive. It's all baked into the system, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's by design. Yeah, it's why I think a necessity of part of the work is it's a political question at the end of the day. It's some level of political and civil organizing, just given the nature of how much capacity and resources these higher levels of government have. Ultimately, I think there is a responsibility of our higher levels of government to ensure that Canadians are being fed, that residents and denizens of Canada are being fed, that there is a not just a moral responsibility, because I think that's a given, but a legal responsibility.
And being fed what they want to eat, what is culturally appropriate, what excites them, what gives them joy to eat.
Yeah.
Not just what makes them healthy. Culturally appropriate almost always makes you healthy, really, in the long run.
Yeah. And being able to practice your food ways, right? So, you know, like, I think earlier we were talking about agricultural production in Hazleton, like indigenous agriculture. You know, you really got to think about like the aesthetic of Europe, like European aesthetic of agriculture is grid lines. It's very linear, right? You have a box, the parcel is a box, you have row crops. To think that like you would come here, and also like the scale of property is something that's like understandable within that kind of European mentality. And then you come to a place like Turtle Island where the, and I put in quotes, agrarian landscape is vast. It is a massive bioregion, and it's a massive bioregion that has been cultivated. Like it has had significant human management. Like it would be just so alien to someone, which is why like the whole terra nullius thing is, pardon my French, bullshit, because it just meant that the Europeans were blind to this level of technological innovation that far surpassed their own, because they could never produce food to feed millions of people across that kind of landscape. It's wild, right? Like those kinds of food ways, I think, are like really vital for how we conceive of like food futures and of food sovereignties.
It's really exciting. It's almost like the conversation that we keep having with the pride cultures, where there's so many different options here that we're dismissing or pushing aside. The same with food sovereignty. There are so many ways of eating and ways of enjoying community together over food that we dismiss, or that they're not interesting to us, and so we don't want them around. We want things to be very binary because that's so simple. We lose so much that way.
Well, I think a big part of that too, Christina, is it's a question of control. It's much easier to control a simple binary system than it is to control a more complex one, or to allow people the ability to have autonomy and agency. Like that is the big one. Again, it comes back to this idea of relinquishing power, that we don't lose anything by relinquishing power. We don't lose anything by not centering ourselves. We gain so much, in fact. That, I think, is the challenging one, though, because there is so much fear attached to the social justice world, because it's always seen as a zero-sum game. So if we give more rights, or if we make things more equitable, then people are going to lose. This is like dominant discourse in certain circles. And so, you know, part of our work is trying to see that there is an abundance there. There's a plentiful or a plentitude that comes about in broadening and being more expansive.
If someone wants to introduce an equity lens and approach into their work, where should they start? What would the first step be?
It's an academic paper, my apologies. We're creating a non-academic, more user-friendly version of it. I would say the first part is, it's a question of readiness. So we come back to this. And I would say like the key elements under readiness is building towards stamina. So if you'll pardon a sports analogy, you don't go from crawling to running a marathon in a month. That's not how you build stamina for these kinds of long-term, long-distance initiatives. Being able to really recognize right off the get-go that what you're attempting to do is and requires long-term stamina is, I think, where you start to build your dispositions. So part of this, I think, is establishing a community of practice or a collective where you can hold each other accountable and where you can provide care and support to one another. So it's not all just on yourself saying, okay, well, I'm not good enough, or I'm, you know, saying the wrong thing and I feel really horrible about this practice that I have, and so I'm just going to shut down and not. Like, you need places to be able to process and move on, to understand that it's not relevant. What's relevant is like being able to continuously show up after you make mistakes and to make repair, both individual and collective, for those mistakes. So in some ways, this is like very basic relationship building coupled with a soupçon of like internal processing of your own. We can call them traumas, we can call them habits. and really like disinvesting yourself from those habits that don't serve that long-term stamina. The other side of it, I mean, is like useful in the sense of being able to understand the dynamics at play. So we talk about applying some analysis, like you can call this research, you can call it just figuring out how things work, and being really open to like how things work usually has some deep root causes that come back to social conventions or legal conventions, cultural conventions that keep a certain group in power. And so being able to like pinpoint where those issues and processes are unfolding is really helpful as people start to organize to be able to say, okay, this is something that really, really needs to change. So a classic example might be, you know, you look at your food bank intake policy, and people who want to use a food bank have to present an address and a proof of income. And so what this means from the person experiencing this is that they're having to go in, they're having to tell someone that they're effectively poor, they're having to disclose their address, they're having to disclose private information. But also the person who's receiving it feels entitled to that information to police access to a charitable function. And last I checked, charity was supposed to be about giving, not about policing. And so I understand like the values behind it, but there's some unpacking that has to happen that might lead then to like changing the policy to make it more inclusive or to reduce some of those barriers to access. It may mean also some fun imaginative thinking where you step just right outside of the box. An example might be, again, let's come back to the food bank. I think that the stats for food bank use are actually much lower than the number of people experiencing hunger. And so that means that people who are experiencing hunger are going to other places to meet their food needs. So how then might we scale some of those other informal elements or formalize some of those elements? So for example, the gurdwaras in my home community offer a community meal for free to anyone. Like you don't have to be a member of the temple to join. And when I was working with them, they were like, yeah, feel free to advertise this out. Like, let people know that they can come to our temple and have a meal. And there's a meal there for lunch and dinner every day. We serve a meal. And so for folks who don't want to use the food bank, maybe the food bank doesn't want to change its policy, or maybe, you know, for whatever reasons, circumventing and finding parallel strategies that meet the same kind of outcome that you're aiming for are really how we start to mobilize things. It also gets you a group of people who are building broader capacity. So what I mean by that is like oftentimes it's a handful of people in a community who are kind of leading the work and are doing the bulk of their food initiatives, which is exhausting. It is a lot of work. I see a ton of burnout happening across the field. And so because part of the mentality is like, okay, well, I have to self-implode to make sure that people are being fed or whatever it is, there's no time to build up and mentor other people or to build the capacity or to breathe life into these kind of parallel projects. And that has to be a vital component of the work, because it's not going to be done off the backs of one part-time food coordinator who's busting their ass trying to do 50 million things, because that's the scale of the project. As a tangent, like I still think one of the most innovative things that we could do for transforming food systems is to have like 5 full-time staff who are being paid to just do the coordination implementation work in a relatively small community, like 10,000 people less. That to me seems like a reasonable amount of people working on it instead of 5 people working off the side of the desk and someone with like 0.2 of their time paid to do it. It's shocking.
I think we're getting there, but I think we're still attached to certain ways of seeing things. Like I was hired last year as a food security coordinator, and they let me have a lot of leeway to do things until they suddenly became worried about their funders being offended by something. And suddenly mm-hmm. they were shutting me down. And I think the vulnerable are more important than whether the funders are offended. And they're also, there's always this power, well, we won't pay you anymore, or your reputation is at stake. And I'm like, I've been homeless. I've been to the bottom. You can't hurt me any more than I've already been there. It's hard to find the right person for the job who's got the chops to do it and the resources and the willingness to stand toe to toe. And I think it's my age that's given me this courage to say to people, sorry, I don't accept that. I think we're getting to that stage where people are not afraid anymore of the power control. I still think that in the world, there's a lot of determination to do the right thing. I still believe that people are determined to be kind to each other and generous and courageous about how they manage their lives and each other's interactions. It's just a question of us pointing out. I mean, this is why I wanted this podcast. It's a question of pointing out, this is what we're seeing, and this is why you don't feel good about it. How do we work around that?
Well, and that was the whole point of, like, part of the impetus of doing the good intentions to impact was to call out a bit of the, you know, you can have the best intentions in the world. You can have a deterministic mindset. You can dream big, but it's about your practices. It's what you do that matters. And like I tell my students, because they often want right or wrong answers. They want to know these kind of perfect solutions to a messy and complex world. And I try to get them to understand that there are no right or wrong answers. There's just consequences, good and bad. They're context dependent. But the question is how you respond to those consequences. That's the value. That's the integrity that you bring. That's how you enact your principles. If your principles are around justice, is around right relations. That's where the rubber hits the road, is in those consequences. It's not in your kind of a priori thinking of how you expected it to go. It's how it actually went. And there's a lot of things that we cannot be prepared for that we then still have to make reparations for. We're still responsible for the consequences of our actions, the good, the bad, the ugly. And that is surprisingly hard to get people like back into that mentality. I'm a bit of a curmudgeon at the age of 43, but it's definitely something that we spend a lot of time working on, is the idea of personal and collective repair, of being accountable to your actions, and then not being afraid to take action because you have to make repair. Because that's probably the worst place to be, is to say, well, I'm never going to do anything because there are consequences.
Well, I remember once, I'm a hardcore bike rider. I have a car, but I much prefer to take my bicycle out. And my sister said to me once, is that not dangerous? And I said, look, you know, I could step out my door tomorrow and be hit by a bus. I'm just going to go. And I'm going to go however I want to go. And yeah, that's, I think, the way we need to live our whole lives, is just go and do what you think is right and what you feel like you need to do today. And yes, there will be consequences. That bus might hit you, but embrace it. I mean, what kind of a life is it if you're just staring out the window, worried that you're going to get hit, or watching somebody not be fed or not eating what they want to eat? Or,
well, that's the thing, right? It goes back to the kind of what I was talking about earlier with this idea of privilege. Like, the consequences for some people is that they don't get to step away from it. They don't have the same choice. And so if the consequence is that we are ending hunger, I'm into that. If the consequence is like everybody has clean drinking water, I'm into that. If the consequence is that people have control over their food system, 100% into that. If the next generation is not looking and staring down the barrel of a doomsday future and sees hope over the next several generations, I'm into that. If people are having a good time and laughing and dancing and the world might be on fire, I'm also into that. I think it has to be kind of in that vein. There does still have to be some levity and joy in it, and it's still tempered in, you know, that kind of sobriety and seriousness, but it can't be extreme iterations of both.
This podcast has always been intended as a navel-gazing exercise, not only for you, our listeners, but for me and Brenda, too. As a grandmother, I spend a lot of time advocating on behalf of vulnerable populations, like the precariously housed and homeless, for the rights of domesticated animals like cats and dogs, and obviously on behalf of the food insecure. So there are themes I see often, but three really stood out as a result of what I witnessed in the summer of 2025. First of all, the right to be included, especially when a community demonstrates nepotism. Access for everyone is so important to a healthy community. In the North, there were countless examples where food is distributed freely to everyone. Then, the right to agency regarding food choices, which is often limited as a result of unfair power dynamics. I believe everyone should have the power to make their own food choices, because no one wants to be rescued. Instead, we all just want to be enabled to decide what we want and need, without intervention or unreasonable limitations and restrictions. Society got into this mostly unconscious habit because of the power dynamics, but people are beginning to recognize that when you let go of power, it's a refreshing way to interact with others. And finally, I want more awareness of the racism that continues to influence Canadian society. No one should ever feel stigmatized over their food choices or their desire to feed others based on their race, their gender, their skill set, or their education. None of that should ever dictate a person's value. Equal access, regardless of who you are, because we all have to eat. These problems don't exist in a vacuum, but are apparent everywhere that there are vulnerable characters, of whom there are increasing numbers in the North. I'm so proud of my northern food producers and farmers who demonstrated such generosity last summer, providing access to food for everyone, giving people good choices of high-quality food, with avenues for feeding themselves and for learning new skills like food competency. Our northern BC community continues to ensure that food security is managed in meaningful, compassionate, and dignified ways. And I discovered this summer that the more you look for people doing alternative work, the more you find them. I'd like to close out this podcast series with Brenda's final thoughts and to thank her wholeheartedly for her insightful leadership on this project.
As I reflect on the conversations that shaped all these episodes, I'm reminded of the importance of acting local, that the choices and actions we take in our own communities are what makes the difference for us and our neighbors. And at the same time, it means looking up and acknowledging the regional, national, and global systems we're a part of, not ignoring the histories and decisions that have brought us here, and staying aware of the structures and resources shaping where we are now. I remain committed to community-oriented food systems rather than commodity-driven ones. And for me, that means paying attention to the human relationships we're building, continuing to ask who is and who is not being served. It means being curious about how decisions are made and recognizing the power and privilege embedded within them. And it means bringing joy and celebration when we share food with each other. I appreciate Colin's reminder of the stamina this will take to act locally with a long-term view, to move from great intentions to good impact, staying open to the consequences and responses that may come that we didn't expect and didn't take into account, to continue to take action, learn, repair when needed, and keep going. And I guess finally, I reflect that while we often hear to vote with our dollar, this is a municipal election year in BC, we also vote with our ballots. So look for leaders who support equitable, community-driven food systems. I want to talk to the people running and see what they're thinking and how they want to approach decision-making in their communities. And we vote with our hearts and our feet through where we show up, how we participate, and the relationships we choose to build with each other and the ecosystem we're a part of. Thanks, Christine, and for everybody who's been part of this project and part of my learning through it.
This podcast was generously funded by the Public Health Association of BC. Brenda Barrett is my co-lead and the executive director of the Storytellers Society in Hazelton. Technical production by Christine Bruce. Music by Elijah Larson. Our food expert in this episode was Colin Drain in Victoria. For more information on this or any other episode of Tempest in the Stockpot, visit storytellerssociety.org/tempest. Thank you for sharing all of these meals with us. I'm Christine Bruce, reminding you to vigorously stir that pot. Reimagine and celebrate the alternative food systems that are springing up all across this country. Encourage your farmers and local food producers as they work to decolonize our food systems and practices, allowing us to embrace the sustainability and equity that gives everyone dignity and agency over their food choices.